Chapter 20. No Wasps Need Apply. Avrakatos was not a morning person. By the time he left his row house in McLean, Virginia, and placed his plastic coffee cup on the special holder next to the driver's seat, most of the agency's senior officers were already at their desks. It was just a 4 or 5 minute drive to Langley, and everyone would immediately recognize the Greek by his car. It was a 1976 Emerald Coupe de Ville, the last of the truly big Cadillacs, with tufted green damask upholstery and a CB radio antenna jutting up from the back. Avrakatos had bought it in Philadelphia from a mafia teamster guy in a bar. It was a strange sight, this would-be wrecker of the Soviet Empire maneuvering into the line of spaces reserved for Chuck Cogan and the other understated senior officers running operations around the world. Bill Casey would arrive in a chauffeur-driven car. Most of the other cars in the line where Avrakatos was authorized to park were BMWs, Mercedes-Benzes, or Saabs. There were a Jaguar and a few Porsches, even a Ferrari. As far as Avrakatos could make out, there wasn't an American car in the whole row. The Greek took a perverse delight in pulling into his parking spot and greeting his fellow officers with excessive good cheer. The preposterous hubcaps on the Cadillac were priced at $200 each. He knew it embarrassed his well-bred colleagues to see a fellow officer in the kind of car, as he says, that only gangsters and niggers drive. After work, Avrakatos would sometimes stop in front of the building to offer his secretaries a ride home. Susan, the beautiful black woman who always passed on information to him and who'd had a shouting incident with Alan Fears, used to complain each time she got into the gaudy machine. "I hate it. Everybody's looking at me. They think I'm some kind of whore. Why can't you buy a white man's BMW or something?" she'd ask him. But the Cadillac was his badge of honor as well as a kind of shield. His mother had taught him about the evil eye, that ancient belief that certain people have the power to do all kinds of harm just by wishing ill on an enemy with a stare. Gust had more than his share of enemies, and the Cadillac was a kind of amulet, a message to all those who might have bad intentions that they shouldn't screw with this street fighter. He was now 47. His entire adult life had been spent in the CIA. It was home. But once he left the car, Avrakatos only occasionally entered through the agency's front door, where lines of nameless stars, each commemorating an officer killed in the line of service, are chiseled into the white marble walls. He figured he had known almost half of the case officers on the wall, 8 alone lost in the bombing of the Beirut embassy more than a year earlier in April 1983. Gust had particularly mourned Deputy Station Chief Ken Haas, one of those brilliant, exuberant tough guys who'd reminded Avrakatos why he loved the CIA. The two had gotten drunk together in Frankfurt. Gust had known he could count on Haas if there ever was a crisis, but some Iranian scum had wasted him. Avrakatos was not the type to stop and stare, but the symbolism, designed to inculcate a sense of mission and sacrifice in the minds of the agents of the clandestine services, was not lost on him. The reason he chose not to pass this way was because of a new scanning device that tended to reject his plastic ID card. Throughout the day, he treated his card like a string of worry beads, picking away at its edges, bending it back and forth, and thus altering the electronic signature. It was embarrassing to be turned back from the front door, so he usually took the side entrance, where an old scanner never denied him entry. His office was on the 6th floor, but it didn't really matter what floor you were assigned to at headquarters. All of them looked the same. Occasionally, Gust would think how weird it was to be back in this white-walled, sterile atmosphere where everyone wore coats and ties and pretended to fit into a mold. He knew it was a lie. He understood the thinking behind the minimalist architectural style. Its Spartan design was supposed to promote discipline and purpose, but it was a fraud. Overseas, a case officer was an individual, swimming in the inky sea of the culture he was part of. He led a life without any real rules. "You can do almost anything except screw naked little girls, but then you're supposed to come back to Langley and be Mr. Goody Two-Shoes. No one likes it." At times, Avrakatos would wander the halls, just to see the way everyone lived and worked. It wasn't really done in this compartmentalized world, but Gust knew he would find a certain amount of jazz once he opened one of the white officers' doors lining the corridors of Langley. According to Avrakatos, the agency at that time allowed its officers to paint the inside of their doors whatever color they wanted, so there were blues, yellows, and greens. It was a way of establishing one's independence. Farther inside, there were the trophies from days abroad, menacing masks from Indonesia, shrunken heads, Buddhas, icons, and always posters from the exotic places where these case officers had once roamed. Avrakatos understood that this was what kept everyone sane, kept them from feeling humiliated by the sterile bureaucratic sameness that made it seem as if they were all lab technicians instead of espionage agents for the greatest country in the world. The South Asia Operations Group, the formal name given to the agents assigned to the cluster of countries through which Gust exercised so much clandestine power, was located on the sixth floor, one down from the director's floor in what is called the vaulted area. These case officers were responsible not only for the Afghan War, but for India and Iran as well. The entire suite that made up the South Asia Operations Group was nothing less than a giant strong room with a heavy metal door and a combination lock. They didn't even have to put their classified documents into safes when they went home at night. The office was the safe. It was easy to know which suite belonged to the Iran branch. Persian rugs covered the floor. Maps and Iranian flags hung on the wall, along with a huge picture of the young Shah entitled The Hope of Democracy of Iran. His father, Reza Shah Pahlavi, had been installed by the CIA in 1953. Now, 5 years into Khomeini's virulently anti-American regime, Gust's Iranian agents had pulled off what they considered a master technical strike. They had blocked the TV signals on all Iranian channels and broadcast a speech from the young Shah. There had been a caviar and Russian vodka party in the Iran section that day to celebrate this stunt. There was little the agency could do directly against Khomeini, but indirectly it was doing tremendous damage by providing covert assistance to Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis for their bloody war with Iran. As explained by Ed Jinowitz, Avrakatos's patron and the number two man in the operations division at that time, they were just leveling the playing field. "We didn't want either side to have the advantage. We just wanted them to kick the shit out of each other." Gust's Iranian officers would look at satellite photographs that showed the human waves surging into battle. Hundreds of thousands of Iranian teenagers, all carrying plastic keys that the Ayatollah insisted would grant them entry into paradise if they died in battle, had already perished in this mindless Muslim war. Gust, too, looked at the satellite images and felt no remorse. Bleeding the Ayatollah was what the Iran branch was all about. In Gust's mind, there was nothing wrong with a bit of realpolitik. He approved of it wholeheartedly and knew he had good men in place in the Iranian section. There was little more that could be done, and he only spent perhaps 15% of his time supervising them. His real passions lay in the neighboring suite of offices. The Pakistan-Afghanistan branch was located in the vault in an area totally lacking in character. Government gray walls partitioned to create semi-private workspaces. Although every desk had a telephone and typewriter, there were few computers. It could have been mistaken for an old-fashioned newsroom, save for the huge map of Afghanistan and the romantic poster-sized pictures of Mujahideen on horseback. A doctored photograph showed a Russian tank with the hammer and sickle insignia looming in front of the Houses of Parliament. The inscription read, "This year Afghanistan, next year London." Gust's propaganda team had the same tank in front of the Arc de Triomphe. This year Kabul, next year Paris, as well as ones for Germany, Holland, and Italy. On the surface, officers working in the Pakistan-Afghanistan branch looked like everyone else in the operations directorate. They were respectably dressed and well turned out. But there was a difference. For all practical purposes, Gust might as well have placed a sign on the outer door that read, "No wasps need apply." The entire staff of the Afghan branch numbered only 14 men and women. Rounding off, Gust referred to them as the Dirty Dozen. It would remain an article of pride with Gust that the core group stayed small, even as the program grew to almost $1 billion a year. The numbers were deceptive, because the 14 were able to draw upon hundreds of agency people, both at headquarters and around the world. "If we wanted a pamphlet in German, one guy would go get 60 people to work on getting those pamphlets out. Each person could network and draw on anyone he wanted." Nevertheless, when it came to the core group, this was as large as Gust would permit it to grow. After all, it was good cover. How could so few people be directing something so big? Avrakatos took particular pride in comparing his lean staff to the Central American task force, with its 90 agents bumping into one another as they micromanaged the disastrous Contra War. "I took people no one wanted," he says. "I took the outcasts. It was my way of demonstrating that you don't have to go to Amherst to succeed. Hardly any of us were Ivy Leaguers. I had the worst band of derelicts ever assembled. There was Dwayne, the intelligence analyst, all twisted up from childhood bouts with polio. He could barely walk. It would take him 10 minutes to go take a piss. But he had a passionate underdog streak. He was my walking encyclopedia about the Russians and everything to do with the Mujahideen. And I would use him to grind out bureaucratic memos defending the program from its attackers.